She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, an inspirational and informative place where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. Chapman is known for doing their share and showing they care in a myriad of ways, from selling some of the cleanest fuel-burning and energy-efficient cars on the planet to the countless number of nonprofits they support. They truly are leaders in the business of sustainability and in corporate stewardship, and we appreciate their support and all they do to make a difference every day. Everybody, please get ready for yet another exciting show and a different show. And of course, it will be inspirational. As you know, I am a very big believer in the big systemic look at our world when it comes to creating a sustainable and socially just planet. In other words, getting rid of the silos. So this is a perfect topic that's in accordance with my beliefs and value systems. Start something meaningful and incorporates these elements that I believe of taking a big picture look and then starting something to make a difference. With me is my friend Michael Tompkins, a true thought leader and action leader. It's great to have thoughts, but what do you do about them when you wake up? And he is a wellness visionary as well. And joining Michael is Richard Blanco, the fifth inaugural poet in U.S. history, following people like Maya Angelou and Robert Frost. I welcome you both. I will be telling people more about your backgrounds in the second part of the show. I'm thrilled and honored to have you both here, taking the time to be with us, to share with us something you started, Michael. We're going to do a lot of play on words on start something. So thanks for being here, both of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Gina. My pleasure.
So, Michael, what is start?
Yes.
And I think you should spell it. And where is it? Why is it? How is it? Talk to us about Start St. Louis.
Sure. Start is the exact way you would imagine start being spelled, except it has a dot in it, and it's capital S, small t, period, capital A-R-T. And it's an acronym for street art. And one of the things that we're doing is it's a nonprofit based in St. Louis to open a dialogue around healing some of the socioeconomic and racial divides here in St. Louis. It's very timely, in fact, that we should be talking about this today based on the incidences here in St. Louis this week, but more so in the fact that it's been 3 years since the idea began in my mind and then flourished after meeting some of the street artists here in St. Louis. And in that time, I can't tell you, because we all know, we've all lived it here in America, whether it's Charlottesville or South Carolina or Orlando, Florida, or Dallas, Texas, or Chicago, Illinois, or Minneapolis, Minnesota. You know, these issues that we're discussing to open this dialogue are really prevalent in American society today. And the unfortunate thing is we're looking very similar to the 1960s, and as we come up on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King, in my mind, as a 51-year-old man here in America, it makes me quite sad.
It doesn't seem as though we have come that far, Michael. I could not agree with you more. In some ways we have, and in other ways, what an incredible challenge we all face, those of us who want to move things forward and change things. Michael, would you say there's actually a mission around this, around START, and what would that be?
Well, one of the things that happens when you get large collections of people together is that quite often they don't communicate, or the frustration gets to a point where it boils to anger, where it boils to rage, and then ultimately, a productive conversation can't happen. And so when we were envisioning how we could open the dialogue, we wanted to take away that the ego of judgment, of judging someone else, of judging someone else's beliefs. And so we thought that we could do that through an expressive medium of the arts. And the nice thing about art in particular is that it takes away someone else's judgment on a particular piece, because as the viewer looks at it, they make their own decision. And finding the right medium was important for us. And, you know, street art crosses the stratum of economic caste systems. And so everyone from those who struggle every day to make ends meet to those who are, you know, in the top 1%ers of America all can appreciate street art. And so that's how we decided to go the route with street art versus another form.
And I'm curious, and Richard, I have many questions for you, so thank you for your patience. Yeah. You're not going to be there in the shadows. Believe me, you're going to be front and center. Yeah. But Michael, me too. I mean, it fills my well up, which needs filling every day, it seems, these days. Michael, since you've left Tucson, I don't know if you're aware of this, but street art has made a major, not even a comeback, a first time. And there are murals painted all over the city. And I don't know if I would have felt the same about this show a year ago as I do now, because of what it's meant for the development of downtown, for the artists that have been selected to do the murals that are just, there's tours now. They give tours for the murals that are painted on the sides of buildings, and it's become a part of the beautiful culture that's evolving downtown. So street art is special, and it is spectacular, and it is community-based. It's not art gallery. It's street art, and I think that that's so really important. And what it supports, it's all about the community. So I love that. And I want to know, is it a hope? And we'll talk about this a little bit more. How has it been received? I mean, it was your idea. And how has it been received? Have you gotten sponsors? Is the community involved? What's been the response in St. Louis to this incredible vision?
Well, not surprising. St. Louis has not so much embraced the idea of this. But again, we all know what's happened here in this city. But it's not just around race issues, you know, and socioeconomic issues. St. Louis happens to have three of the wealthiest suburbs in America, even wealthier than Beverly Hills, to be honest, and yet the fifth poorest city in America, and so that are separated by one street. And so, you know, it's more than just black and white. And then on top of that, it's a very secular community. It's one that I am very fond of and I love very much, and I love living here. But I moved here 3 years ago, and so I'm still considered an outsider. You know, the famous line in this city is, what high school did you go to? And if you didn't go to the proper high school, then you're sort of excluded.
Yikes.
And so what I did was I took it outside of St. Louis and started to, when I was going to board meetings in different cities or meeting people when I was speaking about wellness or spa, what would happen is I would mention it and people would write me a check. And I then went on to generosity.com, and through grassroots donations for our nonprofit, we've raised about $300,000 to be able to pull off this event, which is going to be pretty remarkable. And in that process, I learned quite a bit about street art. Like, it's not just can and wall. It is spoken word.
Yes.
It is,
yes,
textile.
Spoken word.
Yeah.
Yeah. It, spoken word. Oh, my goodness. So just a little bit more about the event, and then I have many questions for Richard. So day one, first of all, it starts on September 30th. So it's coming up very soon. And I'm very, very sad that I cannot be there. And I hope I will be next year. But I'm leaving on a trip to the Amazon, which is where my journey began, shortly thereafter. But it, to me, it's something that it would be Mrs. Green on steroids. I'd be running around putting a microphone in everybody's face, asking them, could you tell me what you think about it? So there's always next year. But it's September 30th and October 1st. And you have very consciously divided that into 2 days. Day one, tell us about that. And then day two, I mean, I obviously know the answers, but I loved that almost segregation and then integration is how I saw it. So tell me what you saw.
Well, you hit the nail right on the head. Day one is in Forest Park in Langerberg Field. Our artists will be painting on large-scale canvases 10 foot by 8 foot. The segregation's found in our society in black and white, because the truth is black and white. And then on day two, in Fairgrounds Park, the artists will be painting in color their vision of our new community. And it doesn't necessarily mean painting with brush or can. It also could be painting with words, while we're very blessed to have Richard Blanco with us.
Richard Blanco. And just a final comment on that is, one of my very dear friends and a Mrs. Green's Roll team member, Bonnie Gonzalez, her daughter Jessica, who is an amazing woman, young woman, her being selected to be one of the people that painted the murals, and most recently she won the competition for our All Souls procession, which is famous all over the place, the Day of the Dead. She won for that. And to see the transformation in her as a human being, in her confidence, in the way she shows up, in the women's groups that I have her speaking to, her art was her, I wouldn't say salvation, she didn't need saving, but it's been a part of her blossoming and making that, which the gift she has been given, come out. So Richard, we're going to make it all about you right now, because there's a lot about you, and we'll go back and forth. But anyway, you know, it took my breath away when Michael told us that you're the fifth inaugural poet in U.S. history, and you are the featured artist at a street event, which we want to talk about that. But before we do, you have to talk a little bit, share with us, please. You don't have to. I'm asking you. I hate it when people say you have to. Please, will you talk about One Today, which is the poem you actually recited for President Barack Obama's inauguration on 2013. I mean, I listened to every word a couple of times, and it didn't even seem as though you were nervous. How did that happen?
You imagine, it's been an amazing journey. I still remember getting the call on December 12th, 2012, and having 5 weeks to write three inaugural poems.
So you're kidding. That's how it happened?
Yeah. And so it was just like winning a lotto without ever buying a ticket. But where can I begin? So many things, of course, of that poem that was my own issues, my own sort of place in America, my own questioning, and I think all of that comes through. One of the hardest things about writing with a poem was that, in some ways, as a Cuban American, as a gay man, I kind of still felt that I didn't have a place at the American table. You know, part of me felt that way. One of the hardest things was to sort of find the emotional authority to say, you know what, I can write this poem for us. It's not about, it's, you know, it's for our country. And so that was part of the journey that you see in the poem, was that basically I wanted everybody to come home. I wanted everyone to take their place at the American table. And it really is a catalog, a sort of a Whitman-esque kind of catalog of all the faces of America as we move through our day. And that's how the poem originated. It was like all art. In part, it is a very sort of personal question, and in part, it's a very public question as well. That's how the poem came about. I really wanted to say something also that changed my life, not only in terms of writing the poem, with the poem meant to me, how I felt about being an American after that experience, but also something in relation that to what Michael was saying, that poetry itself is also, in a way, street art. It was the original long before there were movies, and even long before there were novels and whatnot. The poet in poetry was kind of the village voice. It was a way that people sort of gathered around to talk about things. And actually, spoken word still follows that tradition, and even rap that eventually became, eventually evolved, was marginalized communities sort of having a way to invent it, to talk about these things, people that weren't in the news, people whose issues weren't in the news. So I love that connection to street art, because I think, much like fine art, sort of poetry has also gotten a little bit away from its service, its civic role, its in the name of society or its social consciousness. So I love that connection to this whole concept, because poetry, in a weird way, on the surface one might think, well, you know, these people are painting, this guy's writing a poem, but it actually is the same. It's really generated out of the same space.
From a long time ago, and I remember, I mean, believe it or not, I don't even think Michael knows this, I was a Shakespeare major. And
oh, wow.
I remember laughing at Shakespeare, and my husband saying, "Are you reading Shakespeare?" And I'm, "Yeah." And he goes, "Are you laughing out loud?" And I said, "Yes, because once you understand Shakespeare, he's hilarious, but very political and making fun of things at the time. So in terms of poetry and then the evolution of spoken word, I mean, it got people in trouble, like a lot of trouble, because they were usually talking about political unrest or, you know, the Tories and the whatever. So it's very much, it's interesting because it's usually related to, you know, race and performance. There's always a message. It's very intentional. It's like a lot of music. So when I first heard it, I don't even want to tell you what I called it, but I was telling my daughters, and you know, I'm going to be 67, still hot, hip and happening, I might add. But I called them and they were like, I was explaining it and I called it something, you know, and they go, "Mom, spoken word, yeah, that's what it is." So it's when once the first time you hear it, and it was only about 4 or 5 years ago, I was just so absolutely enthralled. Would you mind just reciting the first two stanzas of one today so that people get a feel? Even with those first two, I don't know if you call, I used to call them stanzas, but verses, just read it to us if you would, or recite it, and then I have, you know, just comments on two of the stands, the quotes that are in there that really hit me.
Yes, sir, certainly.
Go ahead.
One, for sure. One today. One sun rose on us today, kindled over our shores, peeking over the Smokies, greeting the faces of the Great Lakes, spreading a simple truth across the Great Plains, then charging over the Rockies, one light, waking up rooftops, under each one a story, told by our silent gestures, moving behind windows. My face, your face, millions of faces in morning's mirrors, each one yawning to life, crescendoing into our day. Pencil, yellow school buses, the rhythm of traffic lights, fruit stands, apples, limes, and oranges, arrayed like rainbows, begging our praise. Silver trucks, heavy with oil or paper, bricks or milk, teeming over highways alongside us, on our way, to clean tables, read ledgers, or save lives, to teach geometry, or ring up groceries, as my mother did for 20 years, so I could write this poem for us today.
So do you think that I want you to go on and on and on? It's like, if the room was full, you could definitely hear a pin drop. And of course, I'm all filled up with tears because that's the kind of impact this poem has. So what kind of silent gestures are moving behind windows? As someone that loved poetry, what is that?
I think that's sort of a reference to, I'm just picturing there, like everybody sort of lives, you know, getting ready for work.
Right,
or
right.
Feeding the kids at, you know, at the table. And just our shadows are sort of behind these windows, just with, filled with our lives, the everyday, which is the extraordinary. And that's what poetry wants. Usually, that's my definition of poetry, is to find the extraordinary in the seemingly ordinary
of our daily life. Yes. And I just got the 2-minute warning for the first break, which blows me away. If we have time for you to answer this adequately, great. If not, we'll pick it up after the first break. But as my mother did for 20 years, so I could write this poem, talk about that. It was beautiful. It jumped out at me and I'm sure speaks volumes about the life that you had once you came. We're going to talk about that too, how you got here, but that's in the next segment.
There's a couple of autobiographical references actually in the poem that I think really make the poem, because as I said earlier, I am one of these people wanting to be in this landscape as well, and just being vulnerable in that landscape and realizing that my mother's one of these people, that my life and is in this poem as well, so that I'm not just, a disembodied voice or, you know, talking head, a poet just telling us how we should live, but rather that I'm figuring it out, or I'm part of this narrative and trying to figure it out just like everybody else is. And so those moments, there's another one about with my father, and another one about myself also, you know, that, so yeah, it was to sort of be vulnerable in the poem and know that I'm as Jane Hirschfield said once, a poem, sometimes I'm probably going to mess this up, but the poem is in some ways just a poet extending their hand and saying, me too.
What a way to end this segment. We'll be right back, everybody. Please stay here with me. More from Michael Tompkins and Richard Blanco. You won't want to miss a word.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we're certainly giving you some wonderful things to think about for this hour. Thanks for listening. We are talking about Start Something Meaningful, which indeed our guests are reflective of today. It's an amazing story. Joining us for this hour is Michael Tompkins and Richard Blanco. Michael has been a hospitality, wellness, and spa visionary for more than two decades. And I want to tell our listeners more about both of you, so just allow me a couple of minutes. Michael has held senior executive positions for celebrated brands at Canyon Ranch Health Resorts, Turning Stone Resort and Casino. He was the CEO of Miraval, which is how I got to know Michael, the CEO Hilton Head Health and CEO Palm Health. And his forward programmatic thinking has made him a noted keynote around the globe with more than 20 speaking engagements annually, which, trust me, is a lot. In addition to which, he is truly an amazing human being, says Mrs. Green, who cares deeply about his work and about others. Joining Michael is Richard Blanco, yet another truly amazing human being, I am learning. He is one of the most beloved and influential poets and storytellers today. As a historic presidential inaugural poet, public speaker, teacher, and memorist, which I learned a new word, he continues to travel the world, inviting audiences to reconnect to the heart of the human experience and all of its beautiful diversity. So we need this. It's a very pivotal time in the history of our country, and Richard Blanco shows up in my life. As we said before, he is the fifth inaugural poet in U.S. history. He was selected by President Obama, and he ranks among such luminary poets as Robert Frost and Maya Angelou. And Richard, I wonder what you feel when people say that, and it's written a lot. It's like when you make it to the ranks of Robert Frost and Maya Angelou, you have arrived. And I have to add this, the youngest first Latino immigrant and gay person to serve in such a role. He read his inaugural poem, One Today, at the official ceremony. And I get to interview him on Mrs. Green's World. So I want, don't hold your applause. I'm so lucky. Now I want to ask Michael, not only how did you select the artists, which I think is a really good question for you to answer, but how did you find Richard? And how did you select him, a poet, to be one of the biggest, it's a big deal that he's going to be there. How did you pick him? How did that come about, Michael?
Well, I like to say that the artists actually found Start in some ways, quite honestly, and that the universe made this happen. But I was looking for a roster of artists who were diverse. I wanted both the black and white, Asian, and Latino communities represented. I wanted women to be represented heavily. And I wanted to make sure that all of them had diverse backgrounds in some way. And so the first person I actually reached out to was a textile artist. He's actually a multimedia artist here in St. Louis, Basil Kincaid. And I was so blown away by Basil's work. He's a quilter. A phenomenal artist, and with a strong standard point of view, And he really knows inner city St. Louis. He's born and raised here. And so I went to one of his shows and then subsequently had breakfast with him, and he gave me quite an education on street art, not just being, you know, the can and wall that we had talked about. And so he started to introduce me to local artists, and then, of course, I had found some street artists on my own. And once I found, you know, the number one street artist in the top street artist here in St. Louis, they said, well, we know this street artist from L.A. or this street artist from San Francisco. And ultimately, we ended up with an amazing collection of street artists from around America that are very diverse. So we have, you know, Kid Lou from New York City, and we have the Apexer from L.A., and we have Finch from San Francisco. And in the street art world, these guys rank, you know, very close to, if we had an American Banksy, that would be it. And then Pete Ives and Kababi Bayok and Gecko the Mad Scientist, all here from St. Louis. And then I started to meet the women of the group. And most of the women are hardworking single moms. They are they do textiles, and they do fabrics, and they do painting, and they do spoken word. And artists like Eugenia Alexander and Dale Chambers. And it was very, very soon that I met Patia Anderson. And Patia Anderson is a poet here in St. Louis. She spits poetry like nobody I've ever seen before live.
I love it.
When she says it. She grew up in church here in St. Louis. And in church, she said that when you did something good, they made you do it all the time. And so she read a poem when she was a young girl. And now she has become probably the best spoken word poet that I could find in St. Louis. And she had mentioned that she had worked with former inaugural poets. And when I had mentioned this to a very close friend of mine in the spa industry, she said, well, I happen to have a contact with Richard Blanco, and you really should read his poetry. And when I did, I read a couple of his poems, and I knew that he would be perfect for Start. So I reached out and begged him.
That's sometimes how I get guests, Richard. Kelly reaches out to them and begs them, and even people like Jane Goodall say yes, so begging works. But what a wonderful story. And, you know, Richard, I want to go back to that because I wanted to ask you, you know, you got that call from the White House saying, you know, can you do the inauguration? Yeah, that was a day that you'll not soon forget. How did they find you?
They still haven't let me know exactly. It's still a little bit of a mystery.
And it's okay because they did it.
I think because I've had several occasions to sort of sit with the president since then, and in conversations with him, I can only gather that there's an affinity in terms of both our childhoods, in terms of sort of thinking about who we were in America and our place in America and the American dream and what that meant and if that was part of us. I mean, in his case, there's also a layer of race to have to deal and contend with. So I could see a little sort of Ricky Obama sort of asking those same questions as I did when I was a kid or even fourth on Thanksgiving, you know. So I think that's where the connection is. I also visited Hawaii for 2 weeks at a residency at the Aulani School, and it's really interesting because getting a real feel for Hawaii felt a lot like the way Miami felt when I was growing up here. You're kind of part of the United States, but you're not part of the United States, and there's a good and a bad to that. And so I could see there's an affinity there. So I think that's partly it. But I actually, you know, I don't want to know either because I'd rather remain in my romantic.
I love the
romantic
person
of him sitting in the Oval Office and canceling his meeting with Putin because he was reading my poems or he and the First Lady sort of snuggled up. I always pictured them in striped pajamas somehow, and they're reading my poetry like, you know, Ricky and Lucy somehow in twin beds because. That's the way I imagine it.
It's one of my favorite shows. I'm just going to admit it. It's on really in the morning here, and every once in a while, it's like they're just classic and timeless. Really,
yeah. I think they bring up a very important question. You know, there was like, you know, this contrast of thinking about the American question. America is a question. You know, it's still a narrative. It's still an it's still a story that a work in progress, as I like to say. But I think definitely if you look at the president's biography, which is just as attractive. I mean, beside the politics, I just him as a figure of what America really sort of what America can do for our life, I think is such one of the most positive things and examples that we can take with us. So, and I feel the same way, ironically, in the sense that his choosing me made my story sort of from this little sort of chubby gay kid growing up in a suburb of Miami sort of made it an American dream story as well. Not in terms of wealth, but in terms of, you know, what we're talking about.
Yes.
The real story.
Yes, the real story. So I want to ask you this, and I hope it's not a painful question, but are both or either of your parents still alive?
My mother's still alive. I actually
was she doing the happy dance when you told her what was going to happen?
Yeah. Well, we couldn't tell anybody for about 3 weeks, so that was kind of interesting. But my mother, she's still sort of very proud and sort of,
I would think, yes. All that ringing up groceries, yeah.
I'm actually living with her now here for 3 months because I'm a visiting professor at my alma mater in Miami, so I'm back in my childhood home, in my childhood room, and all that. So.
Full circle. I mean, in Miami, where you have such a progressive mayor and such a not so progressive governor, but we're not going to talk about that because there are wonderful things to focus on here, and my ADD is not kicking in. I don't want to go there because this is about peace and compassion and building something positive. I'm saying that loudly to myself. So I'd like to ask both of you a question. In terms of the arts, in not just in terms of street art, but in general, since you are both have the soul of artists truly, and I know Michael certainly a lot about his love of art in general and his love of people. So what kind of role do you think, if any, can art have in terms of an impact on communities? How can it help with healing and bringing people together? Not just, your start in St. Louis, but in general, we have forgotten that so, so sadly. It gets eliminated from curriculum, but how important is it in both of your minds and hearts?
Well, if I were to go first, I would say that anytime that someone has the ability to express themselves through creativity as an outlet is a form of relaxation, is a form of self-healing, and that to me, I think, is very important. But as it relates to art in particular, as Start relates to art in particular, I had a conversation recently with Deepak Chopra, and he said to me, if you look at the most beautiful city in the world, it's considered to be Florence, Italy. And the emperors at one time in Florence gathered artists from around the world, some of them through slavery, like here in America, and brought them to Florence and said, create the most beautiful city in the world. And I had the opportunity to go to Florence for the last couple of years in a row and literally look at the city. And the other thing he said to me is that in order to have a thriving community, you need creativity and diversity.
Wow.
And that's what Florence had. And to this day, it's still considered the most beautiful city in the world, a couple thousand years later, and it's always thrived. And it's because of that, I think it can bring about social change. And in particular, that's what we need here in St. Louis. And so I'm hoping that Start can open that dialogue.
And Richard, how do you weigh in on that in terms of art as it's almost like a social justice opportunity.
Right. Definitely always fulfills some dimension of that role. I think my answer would be very similar to Michael's, but in the sense that artists investigate the world in a different way and often examine the gray area of what an issue is. They give us new ways to think about ourselves and about each other and our relationships to each other. They connect us ultimately to our shared common humanity. And I think in that you have prosperity, not prosperity, not just in terms of wealth, but of the sort of an emotional prosperity, of spiritual prosperity that artists just are that's their role. That's what they're wired for, you know? And it's something I always try to do in my work, because one can get very black and white also in one's art, you know? And to me, I might write poems of protest or whatnot. I need to offer a way out. A way out for us. I need to offer hope. I need to offer some kind of vision. And I think all artists sort of try to do that, or all art tries to do that in some ways, a new way of looking at something. There's always a metaphor that I like to use, or an analogy of, to me, art is really a mirror, in the sense that what artists are doing is they're looking into that piece of work, that piece of art, as a mirror in which they're trying to find or make sense of something they're feeling, something in their life, someone in their life, some event in their community. But also the viewer or the listener or whomever is also standing in front of that same mirror. And it's in that blurring of those lives that something really magical happens. That doesn't happen in any other sort of human rhetoric, right? And so that's what I try to operate as. I didn't invent that. I think it just came with the art. But it's just giving us new perspectives on how to think about things. And the more there is divide, the more we need artists. And I think what Michael was saying about Florence is a great idea. A great sensibility that to prosper, for something to be beautiful, not only in the physical sense, but in the spiritual and emotional sense, that there has to be that kind of thinking has to happen, and that kind of thinking about that art brings into the fold.
And for me, listening to both of you, there's something about art that can be, it's rather benign, usually. It's non-threatening sometimes, but it's still a way to me to bring people together in community, whether it's an art gallery opening or something at a street fair where there are musicians playing, or, as I said, the murals in downtown Tucson. Michael, I hope the next time you're here, you come and see them. It's one of the many beautiful things that are happening here. So let's talk about art a little bit more deeply, because, you know, my background is in health and human services, working with at-risk children. And there was always, to me, the obvious, as I got more into it, being born with white privilege and all that that means, not being a racist at all. You both know what that means. But I was born white, so I had to never even consider facing some things that people of color do. But what I found so many times, my parents weren't taking us to the Louvre every year and reading, taking us to galleries and all that. But art was accepted and respected and recognized, and it was part of our upbringing. Is there an even bigger divide? What I saw was this wasn't the same opportunity for kids in underprivileged, at-risk, communities. They're too busy making their life, finding food and jobs and surviving, let alone art. Is this a way that helps, close that divide a little bit? I'd like, does that question make sense? Is it a way that doesn't cost a lot of money and doesn't require your parents to be college educated? It's their voices.
Well, my answer to that, Dana, is twofold. First of all, the short answer would be yes. The longer answer would be if you have access.
Yes.
And one of the things that happens here in St. Louis is it's a wonderful city in that it opens to our museums to children for free. And so they could attend it, but oftentimes in inner city St. Louis, they can't get there. And so, when I look at where I live, which is a beautiful mixed neighborhood, very eclectic, lots of different ethnicities, I could probably walk to some of those places. But in inner city St. Louis, it's not just the ability to get to those places. It's food deserts. It's laundromat deserts.
Right.
And so when I, one of the things that struck me about START and you know, we will have children creating a piece at the event as well. And all the proceeds, 100%, no one's taking a salary at START. All of the proceeds will go back to fund inner city programs, both in the arts and for resiliency and wellness in our community. But the number one reason kids don't go to school in St. Louis is because their clothes stink, because they can't get to a laundromat, because one load of laundry costs more than minimum wage per hour. And sometimes those mothers would have to walk more than 20 blocks one way to get to a laundromat. And it's those sorts of things that make me say, what are we doing wrong here in America? What is it that 5 miles from here we can have a school that has its own football arena, its own swimming center, its own hockey rink,
right,
its own tennis foundation?
Yeah, hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll come right back, and I won't forget. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of it, and I am sure that you are thrilled for being a part of it today. The topic for today's show, start something meaningful, and certainly you're learning that Michael Tompkins had a vision as a visionary, and then he was not just a thought leader, but an action leader. Please join me once again in welcoming Michael Tompkins and Richard Blanco. Just a little bit more about them. Michael is an author or co-author to 5 books on wellness, and he is a partner with Huffman Hospitality Concepts, an executive recruiter with Hutchinson Consulting, and the founder of Start St. Louis. And I'm hoping it's going to be Start St. Louis, Start Tucson, Start New York, Start San Francisco. And as for Richard, how could I not share with you something that was included in what was submitted to me as show notes from our show producer? And I just loved it, Richard. So Richard was made in Cuba. I just laughed every time I did it. Assembled in Spain and imported to the United States, meaning that his mother, 7 months pregnant, this poor woman, and the rest of the family arrived as exiles from Cuba to Madrid, where he was born. And only 45 days later, the family immigrated once more and settled in Miami, where he was raised and educated. And all I kept thinking about, Richard, on the one hand, what a great inspiring story. On the other hand, thank God it happened when it did and not today. That's my little political dig right there.
Yeah.
Especially in what, for many of us, are these truly challenging times when it comes to any issue surrounding immigration. It saddens me greatly. So you are a great story about, and so, you know, so reflective of the good part of what everybody needs to remember. These are the kind of people that might have been kept out. We might not have Richard Blanco today doing a poem like One Today if he was stopped at the borders. And everybody knows how I feel. I don't hide it. I don't want to hide it. I am standing up and being counted every chance I get. But Richard, such a compliment to you and your family, because look what came about as a result of your mother being willing to go one place and another, have a baby, and then, oh, here we are, we're getting on a plane or a ship today. And yeah, that's a long story.
Quintessential American dream story.
And we need to hear those and believe in them and remember them. So let's go. I would love you, Michael, to finish, and then Richard to answer it, and then I want to hear some more of your poetry, please, Richard. So, Michael, were you finished? I mean, you're making such a valid point. I hate it when the breaks come up. So it's just like not acceptable. What's up with that?
Yeah, and I can end it quite quickly. You know, when you look at the beautiful schools that we have here in St. Louis, and then you read about inner city schools that have broken windows and black mold growing up the walls and bathrooms that don't work, and you wonder, it's not just about the disparity of income. It's not just about the separation in race. It's about not caring for our children, and that disturbs me.
Yeah, that's you know, like our future, the only future we'll ever have. They're called our children, so that's a really good point. And Richard, if you just want to comment on that, there's no hurrying in Mrs. Green's world. I love people that I have to answer the question fully and not worry about a soundbite. But what is your reflection on art helping, you know, bridge the great divide, which in many days seems like it's getting wider?
Yeah, I'll try to add to some things that some great points that Michael made. You know, art is dangerous, and I think there's a connection to art and class in that regard. The way that class can sort of confiscate art, because the ideas can be dangerous, as you were saying about Shakespeare. You know, that information.
Yes, it can get you in a lot of trouble.
There's this really interesting sort of triangulation between, but I got to also say there's another side to that. I don't think any art is bad. I mean, whether it's still isolated,
right,
it still may, some of those kids with white privilege do something else positive and wonderful in the world, right? So it's always affecting, and there's always a connection. I always think also of Shakespeare in the sense that, you know, you had the Queen of England sitting, you know, on the top, you know, tier, and then you had them, you know, the drinking ale and slugging it out in the pit, right?
Right.
So the kind of art that speaks to everyone and meets you where you're at. And so with that comment, I would say that it's also coming down to the responsibility of individual artists to bring their art to the world, or what role they want to play in our society. I know that changed for me terribly after the inauguration, and then I've been meeting other artists and writers and poets and whatnot who have taken it upon themselves to break that barrier, to say, you know what, I am going to show in a nice gallery, and I need to make a living, and I'm going to sell my paintings, but I'm also going to do and participate in amazing projects like St. Art, like Michael is doing. So that artists themselves also have and continue to step up to break that barrier. But, you know, it's always been the case. I mean, you know, that art is wrapped up with class in some ways and the accessibility, but I think that's the way we break through it. But I would say that, you know, it overall effect of art is toward change. And I think what Michael is doing is, in terms of breaking that barrier, even it sort of will accelerate that in the ways that art is meant to do.
Yeah,
period.
Pump up the volume or put the spotlight on it or something like that. I mean, something really important. And I don't want to forget to ask you a favor on the air here, Richard. If you're ever sitting next to my president, Barack Obama, again, just say I have someone that wants to be on your foundation, and she's a nationally syndicated podcaster. I mean, he is just, to me, in a class all by himself, and I am working, actually, to try to participate in his foundation because they're looking for people, you know, who have big missions and a big message. So moving right along, not putting you on the spot, but you could slip in my card.
We can talk about that later, but yeah.
I'm so just kidding, but he is certainly to me one of my heroes and shall ever be just that. So let's go on to, it would be so wonderful to spend some time before we have to get off the air. Read us a couple of your poems. I think there's one called Declaration of Interdependence that is a favorite of Michael's. So could you share that with us and then talk a little bit about it?
Sure. It's a long one. Do you want me to read the whole thing, or maybe a couple stanzas and then skip to the end, which I think will still make sense?
I think that's a good idea. I think that's a good idea to do it that way.
So I got this idea. What happened is... when Trump was elected, I said, I'm going to write an inaugural poem for Trump. I just thought, what would that look like, right? What could I say to that, right? And I couldn't. and by saying I was going to write a poem, you know, it was not, you know what I mean by that. It wasn't going to be very complimentary. Let me just put it that way. I couldn't.
Really got it.
Yeah. Because again, I was like, you know what? I don't want to just bang the drum. I want to get to something that's maybe even deeper than what we're experiencing right now. And so I ended up writing three poems that this idea spun off. And one of them was looking to the Declaration of Independence. And so thinking about, you know, the three levels of, I wouldn't know if you would call it consciousness, or I think it's a Buddhist principle. There's dependence, independence, and then the highest form of sort of thought is knowing interdependence, knowing that we all need each other to live and survive and thrive and prosper and all the rest. So I took excerpts, and it's funny when you said at the very beginning of the show how things haven't changed as much as we think they have.
Yes.
Where, you know, we take 5 steps forward, 3 steps back. But it's so amazing to hear how the message of that document is still so relevant. It can be reinterpreted today in terms of what we need to declare our interdependence about. So I took excerpts from the actual declaration and wrote in between. So the interruptions you'll see from the language
or
from
there.
But what I was thinking,
it's so beautiful the way you did it.
Yeah, and so thank you. But what I was trying to do is, like, again, like one today, I wanted us to see how we're more like each other than we think. And let's see through the smokescreen of black and white politics to sort of, you know, talk to each other face to face, so to speak. Declaration of interdependence. Such has been the patient's sufferance. Where mother's bread, instant potatoes, milk at a checkout line, where her 3 children pleading for bubblegum and their father, where the 3 minutes she steals to page a tabloid, needing to believe even stars' lives are as joyful and bruised. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury, where her second job serving an executive absorbed in his Wall Street Journal at a sidewalk cafe shadowed by skyscrapers, where the shadow of the fortune he won and the family he lost, where his loss and the lost, where a father in a coal town who can't mind life anymore because too much, too little has happened for too long, a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, where the grit of his main street's blacked out windows and graffitied truths, where a street in another town lined with royal palms, at home with a Peace Corps couple who collect African art, where their dinner party talk of wines, wielded picket signs, and burned draft cards, where what they know, it's time to do more than read the New York Times, buy fair trade coffee and organic corn. And then towards the end, we hold these truths to be self-evident, with a cure for the hatred caused by despair, with a good morning of a bus driver who remembers our name, the tattooed man who gives up his seat on the subway, where every door held open with a smile when we look into each other's eyes, the way we behold the moon. We are the moon. We are the promise of one people, one breath declaring to one another, I see you. I need you. I am you.
So I get to get all choked up again on the show for the 4th time in 10 years. Like, how could you have any feeling in your body and not have that come to the core of your being, which it did? And, you know, I want you to read the part about, you should have read the whole thing because who cares? It's our show. But we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. So can you read that one too? Because it's really powerful. And I'm like, I don't want to miss any of this.
Yeah. And it's interesting to hear that those words were how they end the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
It's interesting. It's so fascinating. One can argue, you know, these are a bunch of white guys with white privilege. But putting it back in the context of time, when you think about that, they didn't have to do this.
Right.
You know,
And
it's still words that we're still trying to fulfill, right? So,
right.
Yes, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. With the dead, with the living amid the flicker of vigil candlelight. We're in a dim cell with an inmate reading Dostoevsky, with his crime, his sentence, his amends, with amending of ourselves and others. We're Buddhists alongside a stockbroker serving soup at a shelter. We are each other's shelter and hope. A widow's 50 cents in a collection plate and a golfer's $10,000 pledge for a cure.
Yeah, Yeah. So if you want to know the one that hit me, and you said like it can be painful or some allusion to that, we aren't doing enough. And that's not a judgment. It's a call to action. When you know, I was a hippie and I believed in this and I marched for that. So what? We have to take to the streets again. We have to take to the phones. We have to take to our representatives, our elected officials. And those are wonderful things. And collect your art and go to Aruba. But now it's time to burn that draft card, so to speak. Get out there and be counted, because there's a lot at stake here. And buying fair trade coffee, which I, of course, believe in, and grass-fed, which I know you believe in, it's not enough. It's just not enough. Right. It's you know, desperate times call for desperate measures, and I, of course, weigh in on the side of that. So I just want to thank you. We're not finished, but just I want to press pause enough to say thank you as a total empath for touching my heart again, which needs touching a lot these days, given the news that I'm following about the EPA and stuff like that. So let's switch back to, we're back in St. Louis. And Michael, I just, you know, quickly want to reflect, like, I'm a Jersey girl, grew up going to New York a lot. And it's interesting to me how all of those communities, you know, we're going to the Polish neighborhood tonight, and we're going to go to the Italian neighborhood, and then we're going to go to the Cuban neighborhood, and then we're going to go to, you know, Little Italy and Chinatown. And there's a lot of harmony and cross-pollination and not a lot of ugliness anymore from what I know. I mean, I lived there, and it wasn't like fighting factions all the time. What do you hope for, like, in your best possible dreams of this? Do you think it'll open some doors? What's your hope for the outcome in terms of a ripple effect, not a great fun weekend for everybody?
Well, it's two things, or three things. The first is that we need to celebrate the artists here in St. Louis that we have, and all of the artists that we have in our inner cities. And, you know, when, as I think about the funds that are going into the art world, how they're controlled and manipulated and slow to come. And we have lots of really talented people, and I found a wonderful collection here in St. Louis. And no matter what I said to you today, it can't do justice to their voices and their work. The second would be that one person can make a difference. If you had asked me 2.5 years ago, would you be able to get this done, Michael, and would you be able to raise the money needed and have people join you in mass without taking a dime of pay, would it happen? I would have said no, and yet it has. And so I think that that is believing in the human spirit and believing that in humanity we need to love and care for each other, and that, you know, the disparities that we see and the conflicts that we have can be overcome with communication. And if people can't talk, then let the artists speak for us.
Right. Okay. Richard, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I mean, what can I add to that? That was amazing.
Seriously, but, it's like that. You want to say at that? You want to say period? The end.
Even for a poet, I'm speechless. No, but I did want to add, sort of where we got started on this just a little bit, in terms of the artist's role also as well. And then when you're saying about stand up and, you know, it's time to do more, that you, whenever something happens in the world, or in our community or in our nation, that, you know, you see spike in art. I mean, there's been a huge spike in poetry ever since Trump's election for obvious reasons. We turn to art again because it gives us, it's a call to action, gives us a new way of looking at the world, gives us hope, it lets us vent. It does so many things on so many levels. And it does stuff that, you know, it's not always, I guess, you know, the same question that you asked Mike about St. Louis, you know, art isn't always about just sort of the final product, the deliverable, or, you
right,
know,
oh, right,
you know, we can check the box. There's ripple effects that happen that we may never understand or see or connect, but they're there. And the way Michael ended that is beautiful. I mean, we just have to believe that that is the way to be, and that is our charge, as whether we're the artists, the community leaders, or the thought leaders, or whomever, that that is the way to be, and art sort of helps us.
Yeah, it will help change lives. So we have, like, this is, I'm getting out of this time warp that was called an hour. Coming up next week, Kelly Fryer, Eliminating Racism, Empowering Women. And on our show on the 3rd, Libby Roderick, Food for the Soul Music. Thank you both. You can find all their social media tags and everything at the website, Mrs. Green's World. But let's get in, streetartistst.louis.org. Thank you two very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.